Open your Bibles to Mark chapter 13. That is where we will be in our lesson this morning. Mark chapter 13. We're getting kind of close to the end of our series in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus is now in Jerusalem. It is the last week of his life. He's entered the city. He's inciting all kinds of controversy and making the religious leaders very, very upset with him. And in fact, the stage is really set at this point for his crucifixion. The religious leaders have been so thoroughly humiliated that they're going to start conspiring to kill him. And really, in fact, you know, you could probably almost read from the end of chapter 12 to the beginning of chapter 14 and kind of seamlessly. But that's not what happened, because we have chapter 13 right in the middle here, where Jesus gives this apocalyptic speech about how Jerusalem will be destroyed. And three of the Gospels have a speech like this of Jesus. Matthew 24, really kind of being the most famous and the lengthiest version of it. But Luke 21, although Luke actually breaks the speech into several parts and scatters it all over his Gospel. But Luke 21 is kind of the main part. And what it is in Mark chapter 13, Jesus gives a speech that is what we would call an apocalyptic discourse, an apocalyptic speech. He speaks in this symbolic judgment-type language that sounds a little weird to modern ears because, well, you know, we don't speak this way today very often. Modern Western readers are not used to this kind of talk. It's cosmic terrors, the sun and moon going dark, the stars falling from the sky, things like that. And because Western readers are not used to this kind of talk, it's very easy to commit interpretational errors or to make mistakes while we're reading it. And so some people just say, well, we can't understand it, so we might as well not read it and ignore it completely. Let's just skip to chapter 14, like I suggested a minute ago. That's not really a very appealing situation if we believe that every scripture is inspired and profitable. And then some, of course, make the opposite mistake. They only want to read these chapters. And, you know, every study I've ever had with a Jehovah's Witness, you know, we'll sit down and like, let's try to read the book of Acts. Okay, and let's talk about Matthew 24 and how that relates to the book of Acts. And, you know, every 10 seconds they want to pull you into Matthew 24 and have some discussion about that. And this, again, is probably also not the best way to approach it as well. And the mistake, of course, yet another mistake we get when we read passages like Matthew 24, or in our case, Mark 13, the parallel, is that people look for their newspaper in here, basically, and they look for these modern day current events, and they say, oh, well, Jesus was talking about, you know, the crisis in the Middle East, or he was talking about the recent U.S. election, or he was talking about any number of other things. Truthfully, the context and the genre do not permit specific predictions about those kinds of things. There might be some way in which we might look at a modern day disaster and go, well, you know, there's some lesson we can learn from that or learn about that from Jesus. But is Jesus specifically predicting that on such and such date in 2017 that this event was going to take place? Well, no, that's not what's going on here in Mark chapter 13. There is a lesson for us in this chapter, a lesson for today that is quite relevant and quite applicable. But before we can get to that point, we need to understand what it's saying. A text cannot mean what it never meant. We cannot skip what it meant for them, simply just to rush ahead to what it means for us. Because if we did that, well, then we would have a very, very subjective approach to reading the Bible, frankly. Passages in the Bible can't mean whatever we want them to mean. Well, I need to get a lesson out of this, and I don't really know what it means, but I'm going to make up something so that I can have an application to my life. But that's a very dangerous precedent to be setting when you're reading the Bible. It's not something that you want to be doing too much of. You want to get application after you've thoroughly understood the meaning of the text. All right, so let's delve into Mark chapter 13 and wander into the wild maze of the language and see what we can learn. Although, you know, we have had lessons before on Matthew 24 and on Luke 21 and even on Revelation. So some of this might be a little bit of review for us even. As he was going out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, behold, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew were questioning him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign when all these things are going to be fulfilled? All right, so here we go. They're in Jerusalem. The disciples see the temple. Oh, they're just so impressed by it. What wonderful stones. What wonderful buildings. Even if it is a den of robbers, at least the building looks nice, right? Oh. The temple of that day was an impressive building. And it's not just the temple that they built in the time of Ezra chapter 6. In the time of Jesus, or shortly before Jesus came, Herod the Great had begun some innovations in the temple, or some renovations rather. He kind of upgraded it and redid a lot of it, made it much more impressive, much more beautiful, really spiffed it up from the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. And by Jesus' day, the temple was a pretty impressive building. The renovation project actually continued long past Herod's death. And even though the main sanctuary had been finished, the actual, all of the final renovations were not completed until like AD 62 or something like that. Which means that, you know, which means, number one, they're still renovating it when Jesus is there. And number two, it gets knocked over less than 10 years after it's finished. So it's basically being built for destruction. Is God interested in pretty architecture, or is this a temple built for destruction? Well, Jesus says it's a temple built for destruction. And he claims not one stone will be left on another that will not be torn down. Haggai 2 and verse 15 talked about a time before one stone was placed on the other in the temple of Yahweh, when he was talking about the exile. Jesus says, we're going back to that. This temple will be torn down. No stones left. And history tells us that this prediction was fulfilled in the year AD 70, when the Romans destroyed the temple and conquered Jerusalem. That fruitless fig tree of a nation will be withered up because it was not bearing fruit. That vineyard, the faithless vine growers will be slain, and the vineyard will be given to others. And so the disciples are kind of shocked that Jesus would say that kind of thing about the temple. The temple's going to get torn down. We're expecting the Messiah to come and overthrow the Romans and reestablish our people in Jerusalem. And lo and behold, Jesus, you start talking about the temple being torn down? Why so negative, Jesus? So as the disciples have done elsewhere in Mark, they question him privately. And, you know, maybe this is just another parable or something. You know, and some secret meaning that he's concealing from us. And so Peter, James, John, and Andrew, the first four disciples, they have Jesus alone on the Mount of Olives. They ask him, you know, what do you mean by this? And they have two main questions here. Verse 4, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign when all these things are going to be completed? So when's it going to happen? What's the sign? And Jesus answers their questions in reverse order. So that kind of gives us our main plan of study for the remainder of this chapter. He talks about the signs first, and then he talks about the timing. So picking up in verse 5, Jesus began to say to them, see to it that no one misleads you. Many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and will mislead many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be frightened. Those things must take place. But that is not yet the end. For nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will also be famines. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. But be on your guard, for they will deliver you to the courts, and you will be flogged in the synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake as a testimony to them. The gospel must first be preached to all the nations. When they arrest you and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but whatever is given you in that hour, but it is not you who speak, but it is the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and father his child. Children will rise up against their parents and have them put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it should not be, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one who is on the housetop must not go down or go in to get anything out of his house. The one who is in the field must not turn back to get his coat. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that it may not happen in the winter, for those days will be such a time of tribulation. Those days will be a time of tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the creation which God created until now, and never will. Unless the Lord had shortened those days, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or behold, he is there, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show signs and wonders in order to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But take heed. Behold, I have told you everything in advance. But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from the heaven, and the powers that are in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory, and then he will send forth the angels and will gather together his elect from the four winds, from the farthest end of the earth to the farthest end of heaven. Wow! So, wow, there's all that language there, and Jesus... Wait a second. Jesus is talking about like the destruction of Jerusalem or something like that. And you kind of wonder at first glance, like, Jesus, how was that even an answer to the question? There's more to come. When we talk about signs, this is where it gets a little confusing. The first few verses of this are him explicitly saying these are things that are not signs. In verses 5 through 8. Not signs. There's going to be a lot of false Christs. There are many people that show up and say, I am. Don't listen to those people. Don't be deceived. There's going to be a lot of wars. You're going to be hearing about wars. You're going to be hearing rumors about wars. Don't be deceived. And don't be frightened by them, because that's not the end. You're going to be hearing about disasters. You're going to be hearing about geopolitical disasters. You're going to be hearing about natural disasters, kingdoms rising against each other, earthquakes, famines. But the key to this section is in verse 7. When you hear of wars and rumors of war, do not be frightened. Those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. The key to this section is in verse 8. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. In other words, it's false labor is what it is. These are not actually signs. These are not really signs at all. It's just false labor. If you've ever been waiting for your child to be born, and you've had the experience with false labor, you know that false labor isn't a good indicator of, you know, well, is it going to be tomorrow, or is it going to be next week, or is it going to, it's not a good indicator of when it's actually going to happen. You're waiting for your child to be born. False labor. It's another false alarm. It's not even really an indication of how imminent it is. And this is the main point that we really want to get across first, is don't be tricked into thinking things are signs that aren't signs. Every so often, you're going to see pop pieces show up in the media. Oh, it's a sign of the end times. Is the war in the Middle East a sign of the end times? Is the earthquake in California a sign of the end times? Is the latest scandal with Russia or whoever a sign of the end times? And you know what? You don't actually need to read those pieces to get the answer to those questions, because the answer is no. It's not a sign of the end times. You want to know how I know that? Because Jesus said that kind of stuff is not a sign. Stop calling that signs. Oh, but and people have said this to me, but false messiahs and wars and international conflict and natural disasters, why, that sounds just like today. Yeah, that sounds like every day. That's the problem. Yes, that sounds like every single generation ever. Of course it sounds just like today. There has never been a time. Show me one time in human history when wars weren't going on, or when wars weren't rumored to be going on. Show me one time. Hasn't happened. But maybe the Garden of Eden. There you go. That's the one time. Uh-oh. There's never been a time when there wasn't some kind of disaster that was ruining stuff for people. Never happened. There has never been a time when there wasn't some false messiah figure trying to deceive people. Goodness gracious, we get them every 4 years in the U.S. These are not signs. Don't treat them like they're signs. Don't be deceived. Disasters, that's just part of the cyclical nature of human existence. There will always be wars until Jesus returns, and there will always be people that are using those wars, using those disasters, using those opportunities to mislead people. Don't be fooled. You know, I mean, some people think that watching the news makes you well informed. I disagree with that. You can watch the news if you want. I just don't think it makes you well informed. No, but so much of what's in the news isn't just a highly sensationalized distraction. And I dare say 99% of what you're exposed to isn't actually, you're not going to care about it a week from now, or a month from now, or a year from now. Because it's just all hot air and smoke and mirrors and things like that. But it sure seemed to matter, right? Don't be deceived. No. There's nothing new under the sun, no matter how much you try to get around that by calling it news. Now, if that's true, and you can't really figure out the timing of it all, and you can't really work out these signs, what do you need to do? Well, you need to have endurance. Yeah, you're going to suffer. And that's a consistent feature of our human experience. Persecution, which is also not a sign, by the way. Persecution is not a sign of the end times. God's people have been persecuted for forever. Sometimes worse than others. Persecution is not a sign either. But it is going to happen. Jesus says they might deliver you. They'll deliver you to courts. They'll flog you in synagogues. You'll testify before kings of the nations. That's part of God's plan. Part of God's plan for you to preach the gospel to all nations. Take advantage of that. Don't worry about how to defend yourself in court, because the Holy Spirit will give you the words to say. Families will betray each other. That's part of the naturally divisive character of the gospel. And everyone's going to hate you for the name of Jesus, but you can be saved if you endure until the end. There's another lesson. Don't be deceived. Endure until the end. What does that have to do with signs, Jesus, enduring until the end? I mean, some of this has almost nothing to do with the destruction of Jerusalem when you really look at it. Why? Well, because the real lesson here is it is a mistake to look, to plan your faithfulness around the signs that God gives. Back in chapter 8, you remember Jesus was having that argument with the Pharisees, and they want to say, "We teacher, we want to see a sign from you." And Jesus says, "No sign will be given to this generation." Why? Well, you know, I mean, I want to be faithful to the Lord and start doing the Lord's will. I'm just waiting for Him to give me a sign. That's not going to happen. You need to be faithful now. But doing the Lord's will isn't something you just wait for. Well, I got to wait for the next major event or the next sign or something like that. You know, you don't know how long. Or you're going to go the other way, too. This suffering's only going to last another week longer, another month longer. God's not giving you His timetable. God's not going to tell you, you know, what it is and what it... And it's deceptive to try to look for and plan out God's calendar based on the events going on around you that are seemingly random from our perspective. You don't know how long suffering's going to last. You're only told to endure until the end. You read Daniel chapter 12, it talks about, you know, how... talk about this persecution is going to last 1,290 days. How blessed is he who endures to 1,335 days? And people want to read all kinds of symbolism into that. You want to know what the real symbolism is? Is that however long God's going to make you endure for, you endure longer than that. That's the point. Endure longer. Endure until the end. Because what a shame it would be if you quit and gave up and then Jesus came back right after. You don't know how long it's going to last. You're only told to endure. Okay, Jesus. So that's a lot of stuff that isn't signs. But come on, can you help us out just once? Can you tell us one sign? Okay. All right, here's the sign. Verse 14. When you see the abomination of desolation standing where it should not be, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Well, that has got to be the least helpful parenthetical comment ever. Let the reader understand. Like, thanks, but what if I don't understand? Jesus probably did not tell his disciples the words, "Let the reader understand," because he's speaking to them. He's not writing them. Probably something, a parenthetical comment that the author of the gospel added after the fact. But, all right, so what's the abomination of desolation? What is that? Well, desolation has to do with destruction, destroying things, ruining things. And abominations, well, you can pick something that's just a total abomination. Number one abomination at the top of every Jew's mind is idolatry. Okay, so some kind of idolatrous destructive force of some kind. Well, that's not very helpful. Daniel uses the expression in a couple of places in Daniel 11 and Daniel 12 to talk about the work of Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, and how he desecrated the temple. Because years ago, Antiochus had sacrificed a pig on the altar of the Lord and rededicated the temple to Zeus in the 2nd century BC, and then they had to fight him off. And, you know, Antiochus' actions were called the abomination of desolation. But that's not very helpful here either, because, well, he's been dead for 200 years by the time Jesus uses this expression. So, what are we going to do now? 200, almost 200. I'm rounding up. So who was the modern-day equivalent of Antiochus and his ilk and his army? Well, probably the Romans, who were idolatrous, who were destructive, and who were basically ruling over and oppressing the Jewish people. So maybe the Romans are the abomination of desolation? And when you see them standing where it should not be, well, where's that? Standing in the temple, standing near the temple, standing around the temple, standing around the city. Well, Wayne, this is a bit conjectural. How are you getting abomination of desolation standing where it should not be and concluding that the Roman army is surrounding Jerusalem based on that statement? Well, the reason why I got that answer is because I cheated and I looked at the parallel gospel account. Now, because if you read Luke chapter 21, I said this is where parallel gospels are helpful. You read Luke 21, and you follow, read them side by side. You get to this point. What Luke says is, Luke's version of it says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. So Matthew and Mark throw in that whole cryptic, let the reader understand comment, and Luke just interprets it for you. Helpful. Thanks, Luke. And we might think, well, wait a sec. So Jesus is saying that the sign that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed is that it will be surrounded by Roman armies. Well, we might think, well, duh. You know, typically when an army surrounds your city, that probably means that, some bad times are coming for you, right? But it isn't as obvious as that. Because you actually have to, if you know something about the history of it, you know that the Roman army did surround the city of Jerusalem and then was actually forced to retreat after the first siege. And here's the history. In the late 60s, the Zealots revolted and destroyed the Roman garrison in Jerusalem, beginning some great revolt. The Syrian legate, Cestius Gallus, took his Roman soldiers to Judea to stop this rebellion. They surrounded the city, like Jesus said, and then the Zealots defeated them. And that was kind of a shocking twist that nobody saw coming. And the Jews got excited, right? We can overthrow the Romans. That was a silly thing to think. You can't win a full-scale war with Rome, the most powerful empire in the world. So what happened? Well, the Roman army came back in full force and destroyed the city. But there were no Christians in the city when it was destroyed because they all saw the city surrounded by armies, saw the sign, and got out of there. They fled to the mountains, like Jesus said. And there's the lesson of history. There it is. You think, oh, well, we've repulsed the Romans. Victory. But what looks like victory is actually defeat. Actually a sign of impending doom. Don't be fooled. Don't be deceived. Don't think the Messiah has come to save their city from the Romans. That's not what's going to happen. Flee for your lives, Jesus says. Don't go down and get stuff out of your house. Don't go in from the field to get your coat. And you better hope you're not pregnant or nursing. And you better hope that it doesn't happen in the winter, which the fact that Jesus even says that, he's like, he's not privy to the actual timing of the events. And this raises all kinds of problems if you think that Jesus is talking about signs of the end of the world. Because if the world's about to end, flee to the mountains. Why? Where are they going? Well, don't go back to get your coat. I'm not going to be able to go back and get anything. The world's ending. What would be the point of fleeing? If you think this passage is talking about the end of the world and the second coming of Christ, well, Jesus' instructions to run for it don't make a whole lot of sense. Because where would there be to run to? And what happens? Well, we get to verse 19. The worst tribulation ever. Worse than any we've ever had since the creation until now. And ever will be. Well, what is that? Well, this is a statement, kind of a hyperbole. You shouldn't interpret it too literally because the prophets talk this way all the time. In Jeremiah, for instance, said that when the first time Jerusalem was destroyed, he said, that day is great. There's none like it. It is the time of Jacob's distress, but he will be saved from it. Jeremiah 30 and verse 7. Daniel 9 verse 12, under the whole heaven there has not been done anything like what was done to Jerusalem. He's speaking about the first time Jerusalem was destroyed. Daniel 12 and verse 1, there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time your people, everyone who's found in the book, will be rescued. This kind of hyperbole happens all over the place. And the problem is if you interpret it too literally, then you start having contradictions in the Bible, which is, there are two locust plagues that are said to be the worst plague ever. There's two kings that are said to be the most righteous ever. And Solomon is said to be the most righteous, the wisest king that ever lived. None was like him before him or after him. But really, you want to say that he was wiser than Jesus? No one was like Solomon in his wisdom. Well, I mean, it's hyperbole. People talk this way all the time. We talk this way. This is the worst day ever. My son says this every other day, it seems. It's the worst day ever. It's the best day ever. He says sometimes both on the same day. There's a point at which it's silly, understand, but then there's a point at which the prophets really would speak this way and really would talk in this kind of language, and we talk this way sometimes. The suffering will be so awful that if allowed to continue, everyone would die. But, verse 20, God shortened the days for the sake of the elect, for the sake of the people He chose. In other words, believers, God has mercy in national calamities for the sake of his righteous remnant. Now, there's still going to be false Christs. There's still going to be false prophets. They might even perform false signs and miracles. There's a lot of charlatans running around now who claim to be able to predict the future, who claim to be able to heal. And most of those guys are probably outright lying. But even if they were able to do that stuff, even if they did, even if one of these prophets occasionally gets one right, gets lucky, that doesn't make them a servant of Christ. Don't be fooled. Don't assume that just because you've been saved that you're somehow immune from deception either. It can happen to you. Let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. 1 Corinthians 10. Don't put your confidence in yourself. Don't put your confidence in mortal man. Stop regarding man whose breath of life is in him. Put your confidence in the Word of God, which Jesus says will not pass away. And then we get to verses 24 through 27, and we get into the cosmic terrors. Ooh boy. Sun turned to darkness. Moon refusing to give light. Stars falling from the sky. Heaven shaken. What is going on here? This is the language of cosmic terror. It makes it sound like the universe is collapsing. Like the fabric of reality itself is unraveling. The world is... It sounds like the end of the world, doesn't it? And there's a lot of wrong ways to read this language. And... So some, for instance, will assume, well, Jesus just radically changed the subject mid-discourse. And some will claim, well, then others will claim that Jesus intended to say, well, no, the world actually ended in AD 70. Good luck defending that one. Hey, look, it's still here. But it ended. I don't even understand that. It helps to be familiar. Well, this is another instance where it really helps to be familiar with the thought world of the Old Testament prophets. They love to talk about God's judgments on the nations in this kind of total cosmic collapse type language. They love to talk about destruction. It's kind of like, you know, it's lights out for Babylon. Well, the sun's out, the moon's out, the stars are out, that kind of thing. And in fact, you can find this kind of language about in Isaiah to talk about Babylon, or in Isaiah 34 to talk about Edom, or in Ezekiel 32 to talk about Egypt, or in Joel 2 to talk about Judah. The sun turned to darkness, the moon turned to blood, the great and terrible day of the Lord has come. Everything that you thought was constant is being unraveled and destroyed. And then on top of that, read the book of Revelation. The same kind of language pops in there. Some people say, oh, well, Revelation sounds just like Matthew 24 or Mark 13, so they must be talking about the same thing. Except that Jesus' discourse here is itself borrowing from these Old Testament prophets, which were talking about something totally different. And Revelation's actually talking about something totally different, too. It's talking about Rome, but some argue that Revelation's about the destruction of Jerusalem partly because of the shared language, which is not really the best way to read the Old Testament prophets. And then we get the Son of Man coming on the clouds. Well, that sounds like the second coming of Jesus, doesn't it? And in fact, and I'm not making this up, the Bible that I am using right now has a heading over this that says the return of Christ on it, which doesn't really... They are making a very, very interpretive comment when they do that. And you know, probably shouldn't always trust those little headings that get thrown in there. Because remember, they were invented by men. So, picture the Son of Man coming on the clouds. And this isn't like fluffy white cloud. This is like storm cloud. Scary. God riding on clouds is a very common symbol in the Old Testament of His presence. Sometimes of His judgment, coming on the clouds to destroy things. Clouds and thick darkness, Zephaniah speaks of. But Jesus appears to be most likely alluding to a passage in Daniel chapter 7, where he saw the Son of Man coming on the clouds to receive glory and a kingdom. And if you know the context of Daniel 7, there's this vision of all these beasts, these four beasts, and the fourth beast is the most terrible of all, and that beast is slain, and the Ancient of Days takes his seat, and they open the books for judgment, and the Son of Man comes, and he receives his eternal kingdom. And Daniel goes on to explain these four beasts are the four world kingdoms. But it's a bit of an odd application of this text when you think about it, because Daniel's context has God judging Gentile nations to give the Son of Man his kingdom. And here, in Mark, Jesus talks about coming on the clouds in judgment, not on the Gentile nations at all, but on Jerusalem. The vineyard is taken away from the vine growers and given to others, the vine growers are now reckoned with the rest of the pagans. Just another beast you are. Just another nation. Slated for the destruction of God. You think all the, remember all those oracles against the nations in the Old Testament, guys? That's talking about you now. That's kind of scary. Kind of insulting, really, to the people in Jerusalem at that time. But that's the way God sees their apostasy. Was there anybody that's going to be saved? The answer is yes. Verse 27. He will send forth his angels and will gather his elect from the four winds, from the farthest end of the earth, to the farthest end of heaven. And once again, I have to stop and ask this question, okay? Because you've got the luminaries burning out, you've got Jesus appearing in the clouds, and you've got the chosen ones of God being harvested from the earth. Now, you're going to tell me that's not talking about the end of the world? And this brings us to a key idea, one that is true of almost every prophetic text, in that every judgment of God actually does point to the end. Every time God has showed up to judge a nation, there's a sense in which, yeah, he's dividing between the righteous and the wicked. He's exacting justice that has gone unanswered up till now. And when God comes at the end of the world, what's going to happen? Well, he's going to separate between the righteous and the wicked. He's going to save the righteous. He's going to destroy the wicked. And justice will be exacted in a very final and profound way that it has not been before. So is it appropriate to use end of the world type language to talk about, you know, this kind of thing? Yes. Is it appropriate to use that kind of language to talk about current events? Maybe, as long as we understand what we're doing. That's the key to all this. As long as you understand what you're doing. You know, it's not that Jesus is predicting, you know, what's going to happen next week. You can't predict the future. You can't do it. The only future event anyone in this room is privy to is that Jesus is coming back someday. Could be today, could be tomorrow, could be 1,000 years from now, we don't know. That's the only future event we get to be privy to. That's it. You know, so we shouldn't be trying to predict things beyond that. That's going beyond what is written and beyond what God has said. And so if we, I think the main point of all of this, of course, is if all we read here is the destruction of Jerusalem and we don't see the application of final judgment for us, then we have essentially missed the point. And just as Jesus and Mark is taking language from the Old Testament judgment prophecies and reapplying them to the destruction of Jerusalem, well, in the same way, the language of those prophecies up to and including Mark 13 can be applied to the end of the world. But make sure you understand what you're reading. But, Jesus, you've answered all these questions about signs, or maybe you don't feel like that's been answered. What about the timing of it, Jesus? When's it going to happen? Well, verse 28. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven. Nor the Son, but the Father alone. Take heed, keep on the alert, for you do not know when the appointed time will come. It is like a man on a journey, away on a journey, who upon leaving his house and putting his slaves in charge, assigning to each one his task, also commanded the doorkeeper, stay on the alert. Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, whether in the evening, at midnight, or when the rooster crows, or in the morning, in case he should come suddenly and find you asleep. What I say to you, I say to all. Be on the alert. From which the title of this lesson is taken. Be on the alert. There's a lesson here about a fig tree. Whenever a fig tree puts forth its leaves, that tells you what season it is. The season that's coming. Summer's coming. Whenever the disciples see the abomination of desolation, that tells them destruction is coming. It's soon. The time is near. Jesus goes on and even says it's going to happen in your lifetimes. Verse 30. This generation will not pass away until all these things take place. In our lifetimes? Not the end of the world. There's some people who claim that Jesus said he did return in the first century and then basically lied about it or didn't keep his promise. That's not the correct way to read this. Because the overall context makes it clear Jesus is talking about the knocking down of the temple according to verse 2. The point is, it's going to happen in this generation. Some of y'all are going to live to see it, Jesus said. My words endure forever, even past heaven and earth. All right, so you can tell the lesson of the fig tree, you can tell the season by the sign. But the exact timing, you don't get to know that. No one knows the exact time. Angels don't know the exact time. Jesus doesn't know the exact time. I thought Jesus knew everything. I mean, there's like the one thing in the Gospels, Jesus says, I don't know that. I don't know the exact time, not the day or the hour. And keep in mind, when Jesus says no one knows the day or the hour, that's actually, he's still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But here's, again, argument from the lesser to the greater. If no one knew the time that that was going to happen, what makes people think they know when the world's going to end? Well, there have been so many times in human history where people have done all this fancy math, numerology, found the secret code embedded in the Bible, whatever it is, and figured out, you know, down to the second, some of them, when God is going to destroy the world, and when Jesus is going to come back, when everybody's going to go to heaven. You know, whenever somebody predicts the end of the world on a specific day, I think, yeah, I feel pretty good about that day. That's not going to be the day. You know, because Jesus says that he's coming back on a day that we don't expect. Just like the master of a house is coming, and you don't know when it's going to happen. Verse 35. The end comes like a thief, many texts says. 1 Thessalonians 5, 2 Peter 3. It's coming like a thief, and thieves don't typically inform you when they're going to show up, because their entire enterprise relies on the element of surprise. Judgment Day, it's going to be a surprise. There's going to be a lot of surprises that come with it. And because of that, we need to be on the alert. You don't know when he's coming. That was true of Jerusalem. That's true of the world as well. Jesus comes for judgment at a time you don't expect. The master goes on his journey, tells his slaves to work on his absence, tells his doorkeeper to be on the alert. He's not telling him when he's coming back. He'll come back when he feels like it. And the doorkeeper should be ready to greet him, whether it's evening or midnight or rooster crowing or morning. If he comes and finds you asleep, well, it's not going to be pretty. Be on the alert. And that's not just a message for the disciples. That's a message for all. So there's your lessons. Don't be deceived. Endure until the end. Be on the alert. Matthew goes on to include extra parables in the process of it. There's two ways to think about it. You know, sometimes you hear sermons, you know, Jesus could come back any second. Jesus could come back before I'm even done with this sermon. And what will happen then for people who aren't ready for his coming? That's a scary thought. Jesus could come back at any second. And if you're looking at your life, and your life is not right with the Lord, and Jesus came back right now, is that going to be an awkward conversation? And Jesus is like, well, why didn't you do what you needed to do? Why weren't you being faithful to me? What did you put off getting baptized for? What did you do this for? What did you do that for? Why are you not ready to greet your master? That's an awkward conversation to have. There's a flip side to this. You know, people always talk like Jesus could be coming back tomorrow. What if he doesn't come back in your lifetime? Are you prepared for that reality? You know? If you live moment to moment, you know, live your life like Jesus is coming back tomorrow. Well, he doesn't come back tomorrow. And the next day, and the next day. Are you prepared for the endurance that requires? Well, it was faithful earlier, Jesus. That's the, you know, you read the parable of the 10 virgins. The foolish virgins were prepared, but only if the bridegroom showed up early. He shows up late. Now they're not prepared anymore. They ran out of oil. They didn't bring extra provisions. They weren't prepared to endure. And because they weren't prepared to endure, they weren't ready for his coming. So it cuts both ways. You can have the spirituality now, but not later. And that's not good either. Are you ready for his return whenever it is? Am I ready for his return whenever it is? We need to be on the alert. We need to be ever vigilant, ever mindful of the Lord and our relationship with him and our faithfulness to him. Maybe you're here this morning and you're not ready for the Lord to come back today. I suggest you get that straightened out. If there's anything we can do to help you in that route, let it be known. All together we stand and we sing.